It's time for Let's Talk Legal with your host, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from the law firm of Harvell and Collins. If you've got a legal question, they can give you the answer. Call now, 1-800-818-2255, and let's talk legal.
Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, and Cecil Harvell is in the studio with us. Good morning, Cecil.
Good morning, Ben.
You know, we've had the pleasure of watching your firm evolve some over the last decade or so that we've been doing this show, and you have brought on another interesting individual to come and be a part of the program, too.
We have. Ben, it's a pleasure to introduce this morning Andrew Foster, who is a new lawyer with our law firm. And Andrew, what we want to talk about today is that Andrew has a postgraduate law degree, believe it or not, in taxation. And many of our listeners might not even know what in the world that means, but there is a degree that one obtains after law school known as a Master's of Taxation. And this degree, is, as I said, a post-law degree that you spend even another year, in graduate school to receive this Master's of Taxation. So Andrew, welcome.
Welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thanks, Ben.
We don't call you Dr. Foster or anything, do we?
Dr. Foster.
Okay, all right. But Andrew, welcome to the program. What does a tax attorney do?
Well, you know, Ben, there's a couple different areas that tax attorneys are involved in. One is on the planning side, meaning that setting up transactions in order to get the best possible tax consequences.
Mm-hmm.
The Internal Revenue Code is very thick. I remember carrying it around at LLM school. They made us actually take the books, between the code and the regulations. You're talking 10, 12, 3-inch thick books. So you want to make sure that when you're structuring a transaction, that you are in compliance mm-hmm. with all of those codes and regulations. So on the one side, it's very important to plan appropriately. On the other side, sometimes even the best planning can even get you a letter from the IRS, and that's when you kind of involuntarily, through a audit letter,
mm-hmm.
Get involved in an IRS tax controversy. And then at that point, tax attorneys are also available to help you through this process.
So Andrew, is this also, are you speaking of both corporate and personal taxes, or is this mostly corporate?
No, it can be corporate or personal. The interesting thing is a lot of small businesses, Ben, actually.
They shade that line, really.
Exactly. Yeah. If you have an S corporation or you have a partnership, those tax attributes are passed through the mm-hmm. business entity to the individual themselves. And so a lot of times it's both entities, the business and the personal side, kind of come together on that aspect.
Mm.
So, Ben, so that was a great, by the way, introduction, Andrew. But let's kind of go more specifically, and talk about some of the very specific things that can happen. Of course, as Andrew was mentioning, on the planning side, be it a business or corporate transaction that needs to have the guidance of a tax planner to make sure that things are favorable for either the buyer or the seller relative to a business, corporate, or even real estate transaction. Certainly, of course, Ben, there is always the planning relative to estate tax planning, transfer tax planning such as gift tax
mm-hmm.
or even capital gain type planning relative to, a 1031 tax-free exchange of real estate. All of those things would fall within the good planning category of what a tax lawyer would do.
Right.
The other area that Andrew mentioned, of course, is on kind of the reverse side of that. And let's talk some about that. I mean, there are these letters that come from the taxing authorities where they are questioning certain returns or certain mm-hmm. actions on behalf of the taxpayer. And you get into such things as tax court representation, audit representation, IRS appeal hearings, And of course, Andrew, help us understand the tax courts. They want to kind of talk to someone like you. Is there a special admission ticket that you have to those tax courts?
Yes, Cecil. I am actually licensed to practice before the United States Tax Court. You have to apply for that, and be accepted. And I had that certification. So I'm eligible to go to the tax court and practice before it. You know, what I always say is there's different life cycles to this. You know, so the beginning of this would be, a letter.
Yeah.
From the IRS.
Yeah, that letter.
And you get that letter. And in the moment that that happens, you take a big sigh of relief. And then I hope that you would call a professional, get an attorney involved. Because the earlier in the process that you get someone with a knowledge base, the better the outcome of the situation is going to be. And that's the important part about it.
Yeah.
Another thing that comes to mind, Ben, is the offer and compromise process. Let's talk a little bit about that. We hear a lot about that. You know, there are even companies that advertise that if you have, you know, a North Carolina Department of Revenue lien or letter or assessment, same with the Internal Revenue Service.
They typically say if you owe $20,000
right.
more in taxes.
Exactly.
You know, typically the ad.
Exactly. So, Andrew, tell us about that kind of representation.
Well, I tell people when I hear those ads, I say, you know, they are correct in that you do need to have a certain amount of tax debt in order to qualify. And the reason being is because the IRS, when you go through an offer and compromise process, I need to back things up a little bit. Let's start and talk about how you'd end up in an offer and compromise situation.
Right.
The way you would end up in that situation is that tax debt would be assessed to you. Now, there's a couple different ways that tax debt is assessed. The first way is that you self-assess. You file a tax return.
Right.
You say, I owe X amount of dollars. And when by doing that self-assessment, if you then can't afford it to pay that tax debt, maybe an offer and compromise process is to you. The more common way to do this is the IRS says, you said you owed this amount, $1,000, but we really say you owe $21,000.
Right.
And then that's how the offer and compromise process can begin I could afford the $1,000, but I can't afford the $21,000.
Is the audit first, though, up? I mean, is that usually where you're going to get started?
Generally, Ben, as I was talking about the life cycle, we kind of jumped around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Generally, the offer and compromise process comes at the very end, and it comes, can I afford to pay what the IRS, the North Carolina Department of Revenue, has told me that I owe?
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer to that is no, I can't afford it, then we need to talk about your options as far as offer and compromise goes, and it's very technical in how that needs to be done.
Okay. All right. Again, we are talking with Andrew Foster, who's the newest addition to the team at Harvell & Collins Attorneys at Law. Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins are usually in with us this morning. Cecil's here along with Andrew, and you're taking your questions, too, at 800-818-2255, 247-7282, 353-4674. Welcome back to our program here on Coastal Daybreak on the Talk Station. Every Tuesday morning, we talk about your legal life on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell & Collins, Cecil Harvell, and also Andrew Foster, tax attorney with Harvell & Collins, is with us. And we have Bob from Moorhead City on the line with us now. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Mr. Foster. I have a irrevocable trust. I have a procedural question. If I, have dividend income in my stocks of $10,000, and I gift out to a college $25,000 in a year, which leaves me a $15,000 carryover. Can I carry that over to the next tax year and deduct it?
Well, we just speak to that. We're not quite sure on that one. We have to probably look into that a little bit more, Andrew. Is that right?
Yeah, I can take a look at that for Bob. I'm not exactly sure on the carryover rules regarding an irrevocable trust with charitable gifting.
Is all the money coming from the trust?
You're right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So this is, Bob, this is, the trust is generating this annual income, which otherwise is reported on the trust return, correct?
Right. That's correct.
All right. And is pay, and tax is paid at the trust level, of course.
That's correct.
Which is, as you know, is a little bit of an uncomfortable level, isn't it, Bob?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So what you have done to try to hedge against that is to donate some of this revenue to a qualified charity.
That's correct.
All right. And you have done that to a certain level, but there is an additional revenue stream that's there that you're wondering if you can carry that forward. We can find that answer for you. We'll be glad to do that, Bob, at no charge.
Okay.
Will you contact us and let us know your information, and we'll have Andrew find that carry forward ruling that code section and look at that and tell you exactly what that is.
Yeah, well, I'll call your office and set up an appointment. I just thought he, since you just got out of school, he might know that.
That's a good guess. And many things we do right out of school, but of course he does, as they say, he doesn't want to speak out of school either.
You can't memorize 72,000 pages.
No, you can't. Okay. But Bob, we appreciate so much the call. That is a classic tax question.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Bob, for putting that out there. And Ben, now, we will get that answer.
Now, does the trust fall under the same gifting limits as a person does?
No. Okay. No, a trust is its own entity, and
right.
It has and certain code sections apply to a trust or an individual or a corporation. This is one of the reasons that we, in fact, right there in that question, Ben, is why we're needing to look at the code provision that applies to the carry forward of a charitable deduction for a trust.
Okay,
that could be different than the carry forward for of a personal charitable
right.
deduction
right. So
each
we
and
make
every
sure
year.
And get our answers there, right?
Yeah, got to get our ducks in a row.
All right, we have Woodrow from Otway on the line with us now.
No, from Hawkins Island Road down East Mobile Home Park.
Yeah, okay.
I got a Mercury.
Okay, wait a minute. You're talking about swap shop. This isn't swap shop. We're talking about legal questions here, so I'm putting you on hold here. And you called in on Swap Shop yesterday, and we had that information out for you. And we can do that again on Friday if you want to call in then, between Friday between 8:30 and 9. So I hope you'll call back then. Thanks, Woodrow. All right, I recognize that when he started, because we had that yesterday. All right, again, we were talking about kind of the process of what goes through typically after somebody gets that letter from the IRS.
Yeah, Ben, you know, I guess that's your ticket to the IRS offices. There's a couple different kind of audits. I guess I should start there. The one audit is we want you to come to our office, bring your materials. They issue what's called an information document request, and they say we want to see your information regarding your home office deduction, regarding business miles traveled, regarding it can be anything. And then your job as a taxpayer, I joke, Ben, and I tell people whenever they get these letters is, you know how you always hear the term, innocent until proven guilty?
Right.
I almost say that tax law is the exact opposite
yeah.
when it comes to tax controversy.
I'm sure that's not exactly comfort.
you have to be honest though.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, the IRS has deemed you almost guilty until you can show mm-hmm. through documentation that you are in fact innocent.
Right.
And that's why it's so important to keep documentation. And again, that kind of brings you back to another letter you may receive, which is just, we don't want you to come to the office. We want you to just simply send in this documentation.
Mm-hmm.
And by sending in the documentation, then the auditor will make the decision. Now, imagine that situation it puts you in. Someone is going to receive these documents at the IRS and then have to rule one way or the other whether these documents are sufficient in order to give you the positions that you've taken on this tax return. So a lot of times, Ben, this particular audit, as well as the in-office audit, lead to another level. Maybe the audit doesn't go in your favor. Maybe you tried to do the audit on your own with no professional help.
Right.
And it didn't go well. Well, the good news is that the IRS and the North Carolina Department of Revenue has a process where we get the audit results back, and then there is a possible appeal mm-hmm. that can be made.
Okay.
And
all right. Well, we have another caller. It's nothing like taxes to bring out folks. Let's talk to Edward in Moorhead City now. Hey, Edward, how are you?
Good morning. My wife works in Greenville, and we live in Moorhead. Is the mileage that she drives to work tax deductible?
What does she do?
She is a nurse.
Yeah. I think the answer to that's no, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, there's commuting rules for the IRS, and the commuting rules would say that answer is no. There is a caveat to that rule, which says that if you are on a temporary work assignment, so let's say that his wife who works in Greenville, they want her to go work in Raleigh for a period less than 1 year.
Right.
If that's the case, Ben, and she makes that commute from Moorhead City to Raleigh every day, then those miles could be deductible.
Mm-hmm.
But the standard commute from Moorhead City to Greenville would not be deductible, and the reason being is because the IRS says you get to choose where you live. You have the option. You can move closer to Greenville if you don't like taking the drive.
Right.
And so they don't want people to abuse that situation, so that's the reason for that commuting rule.
Yeah, and for outside salespeople, that becomes a little bit tricky, too, about where they start their work and where they ended. And so
exactly. Yeah. I mean, you get various rules. I mean, you know, there could be where someone travels from, their home in Moorhead City to Greenville to the home office. That would not be a deductible commute. Now, let's say they start making trips around, like you were saying. They're making calls. They're going visiting businesses from that point on. Well, anywhere they drive from that point on is going to be deductible.
Right.
And I get back to documentation, Ben, because a lot of people don't know this. But you need to, if you're deducting business miles, you need to keep a very accurate mileage log with beginning and ending odometer readings. And you need to have the last key purpose is the business purpose of what were you doing on these calls? Who did you visit? Where did you go? What was said?
Right.
That enables you to take those business miles. And when I mentioned audit, we mentioned letters. One of the major red flags for audit is business miles.
Right.
And the reason being is because the IRS knows people don't keep accurate records a lot of times.
Yes.
So the threshold is high and you have to make sure you uphold that.
Take a short break and we'll be back with more here. Again, Andrew Foster answering the tax questions here as we're getting several of those. Here on Let's Talk Legal with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law, Cecil Harvell and Wes Collins from Harvell and Collins. And you can go online at harvellandcollins.com. Spell it all out, harvellandcollins.com. And you can call for your appointment there too at 252-726-9050. And we'll have more to come in a moment. Hey, welcome back here with Harvell and Collins, attorneys at law on Let's Talk Legal every Tuesday morning here on the program. Again, harvellandcollins.com, great website to go to listen to past shows and get some other information. And also in with us, a newest attorney with Harvell and Collins is Andrew Foster, talking about tax questions, and Cecil Harvell with us as well. And Andrew, we were talking about the process. You said, you know, it may not go well, especially if you're doing it yourself and you don't have representation, but you have some other options after you get that first decision?
Yes, we'll go back a little bit. So at this point, we've had the audit. The audit didn't go the way that you planned. So now it's, some people think, okay, well, the IRS says I owe this money. I'm just going to sign my name. And I'm gonna end this. Well, that's not a good idea, Ben, because the thing is, there is an appeals level. And the great thing about the appeals is that you can make legal arguments, during the appeals conference. You can explain to them, what I like to call the hazards of litigation. Meaning that, do you really want to take this, do you want this to possibly go to tax court? Because you may get an outcome that's not favorable. It's then going to be on the books for other taxpayers to use. And you can kind of use that to say, let's reach a settlement offer. And, I'm sure Cecil said in the past, a lot of these 95% of tax controversies do not end up in tax court or federal district court. Mm-hmm. They end up getting a settlement offer. And, you know, the goal there is to get the best possible settlement you can. Right. And that can be done.
And you know, because it is so complicated, obviously the taxpayer, it can't possibly know all the vagaries of the tax law.
No, for instance, this point that Andrew just made. What he's saying is that at the first level, the audit level, it's more or less just kind of a documentation game.
Mm-hmm.
Your documents against our documents, substantiation versus
right.
Lack of substantiation. All right, fine. But at the next level, there's some real conversation now at the appeals level.
Mm-hmm.
There's that across the table opportunity to compromise, to make legal arguments, to even make practical arguments about, well, okay, Mr. IRS, you know, but it's going to take 3 years to get this issue resolved in the tax courts. It's going to take your time. It's going to take our energy. Do you really want some negative precedent on this? Is this really worth it? And so therefore, you know, you're saying, you know, the audit resulted in a $25,000 tax liability. You know, my client this level will offer you $12,500.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to happen at that appeals level. Well, you know, that's the kind of nuance that most of us are just not going to know.
Right. Exactly.
But Andrew, of course, you know, that's what he studied, and that's the kind of experience that he is going to be involved in, and he's going to have that level of knowledge to guide a client mm-hmm. in that way.
Just a maybe it's a little silly. Where does tax court meet, in just a regular district court room, or is it they have a special tax court room? Or
they actually do. The United States Tax Court in North Carolina meets in Greensboro.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yes. Yeah, so that's where the
tax that's why the IRS office is in Greensboro there too. I mean, we get a lot of public service stuff out of there.
Exactly, and that's where they have the tax court there. They don't want to have their attorneys have to travel very far.
Last but not least, Ben, and Andrew will be back next week. But we've got just 1 minute here. I just want to say this, just because we kind of skipped over it a bit, but. There are two premier LLM programs in the country, one at University of Florida
mm-hmm.
and the other at NYU. There are others, of course, but those
right.
are two on the Eastern Seaboard that many of we lawyers know about. And Andrew, after being number one in his law school class, I might add, attended the University of Florida program.
All right. Well, excellent. Andrew, welcome aboard. Good to have you with us, and
thanks,
we'll see you next week. You can call for that appointment at 252-726-905.